Welcome to the Blackhawks Talk podcast presented by Coors Light. I am Pat Boyle, joined by Charlie Romeliotis to discuss the roster moves made in the last couple days by the Blackhawks. Dylan Strome is in concussion protocol. Connor Murphy is ready to return to the lineup. Plus, why Artemi Panarin has taken a leave of absence from the New York Rangers. And we'll recap the Lake Tahoe outdoor ice fiasco. And later, Ian Mitchell joins me. Is there a comfort factor entering the NHL with a group of rookies? What was it like talking to one of his hockey idols, Duncan Keith, for the first time? And what fast food restaurant did Ian work at as a kid? It's all coming up next on the Blackhawks Talk podcast.
If you travel, you know when it comes to love.
See you soon.
Can't wait.
The sky is no limit. You know with your Delta Amex card, being oceans apart means meeting in Aruba. And booking a war travel with your card means saving 15% on Delta flights. You know kissing under the bridge of sighs guarantees eternal love. Because you're the long-distance lovebirds. It's why you're a Delta SkyMiles Platinum American Express card member. If you travel, you know. Takeoff 15 discount not applicable to partner operated flights or taxes and fees. Terms apply. Visit go.amex/you know.
Born in the Rockies, Coors Light is lagered cold for a crisp, clean taste. Filtered cold to ensure clarity and brightness. And packaged cold for peak refreshment. Because those who thirst for more deserve the world's most refreshing beer.
Charlie, the Blackhawks had their game postponed against Carolina on Saturday. They've had a couple of extra practices ahead of Tuesday night's game against Columbus, but some roster and injury news came about on Monday. Dylan Strome was placed in concussion protocol, and this is from a hit that he received a few games ago, and that may explain part of his six-game point drought.
Yeah, it's unfortunate because when we talked to Jeremy Colliton, he said these symptoms started a little bit after, right? They weren't immediate symptoms, and Dylan said he's been feeling a little bit off, but you never know when you get to a point where you're like, okay, I think something underlying, there's an underlying issue going on. And so maybe this is a contributing factor. I think it's unfortunate too, because I think he was in the concussion protocol a couple years ago as well. So I don't want to say that he has a concussion history because there aren't any like lengthy history for him, but this isn't the first time that he's in this protocol. So you hope that it's nothing long-term and that it's just, they're trying to be cautious with this injury.
You know, I think it's fortunate for the players on the Blackhawks to have a coach in Jeremy that has gone through concussions and had his career cut short, because he is really sensitive to this issue. And he went into great depth on Monday about how he goes up to players that, you know, have been, you know, hit hard or whatever, and asks them how they're doing, then follows it up the next day and then the next day. And I thought the thing that struck me when he was asked about the dilemma that the player is put into about admitting that they may have some symptoms, concussion related, versus playing through and trying to help the team win. And he said something to the effect, it's an internal struggle every single minute. So he understands what might be going through a Dylan Strome's mind, or in this case too, with what I'm sure, Andrew Shaw is contemplating right now. So it's kind of a unique situation, but with where concussions are, how they are handled in sports, how that's changed in recent years, I think it's nice to have an advocate like this for the players as their head coach.
Right. And I think it's so difficult too, because as a player, you don't know what's going on. Like, let's say I wake up with a headache today, you know, it's like, oh, okay, I probably haven't drinking a lot of water, or maybe I'm hungry. You know what I mean? Like, as an athlete, you can't really pinpoint that. So if Dylan Strome, you know, like days later, he's got a headache, and again, we're just speculating here, but just a potential symptom, like you have a headache, maybe you think nothing of it, but then the next day you also have it. And then the next day after that, you have it. And it's like, okay, something must be going on here. And so I think that's difficult too, because it's not like it's a knee injury or a shoulder injury where you're very clearly playing through some pain. It's so hard to identify. And then at what point do you kind of speak up and say, okay, maybe something is going on here where I need to step away and sit out a little bit. So that's also a part of the challenge of trying to identify what's wrong.
And again, it challenges this roster down the middle, which has already been challenged. So you could say their top three centers are all out in Taves, Doc, and Strome for the foreseeable future. Although on Sunday, when they conducted their practice in Carolina, Dylan Strome was on the wing with Soderberg and Janmark. So kind of the way you look at it going into Tuesday night's game, the top line will likely stay the same, DeBrinket, Suter, Kane. That second line might be Hagel, Walmark, and Kubalik. I don't know if they'll push Khrushchev up into the spot that Strome was in with Soderberg and Janmark, and then you would see like Highmore, Kampf, and Carpenter. What do you think how the lines may look with this latest injury to Strome?
Yeah, I think that's exactly what would probably happen is Khrushchev moves to that third line, and then Highmore, they kind of reunite the Highmore, Kampf, Carpenter line that we haven't seen really since the first couple games of the season. It's difficult. Like, we obviously knew going into this year that the Blackhawks were going to be without Kirby and Jonathan Taves. And we figured, you know, going into training camp, Dylan Strome had remained unsigned. And that was a reason why they brought in Carl Soderberg, was because they weren't going to have Kirby, Doc, and Jonathan Taves. And so now you take away Dylan Strome from the equation. And I think it's a really, like, the Blackhawks are fortunate that Pius Suter has really stepped up into a center role, because that's not someone we penciled in into the center spot. And he's been a perfect center for that first line with DeBrincat and Patrick Kane, where he's that puck retrieval guy. So if they didn't have him at the center position, boy, oh boy, like, I'm looking up and down the lineup and it's a really thin, I mean, it even is now, like, Lucas Walmark is serving as the second line center right now based on those practice lines. So it is thin, but at the same time, it would be even more thin if Pia Suter didn't step up into that center role.
And you wrote a great piece yesterday on the Blackhawks trying to work through some of their power play issues. And again, they still are highly ranked, but when you break it down over the last four games, it's what, 2 of 12? Yep. And, you know,
it was about to be 1 of 13 or 1 of 11, right? But they got that garbage one.
And the other was Khrushchev's Dangle City goal. So not even a traditional power play type tally. So they've struggled. They struggled too, because they don't have any right-handed shots on this roster. I mean, you look up and down. If there's one area of criticism, maybe with how this whole thing has been put together, it's like the lack of right-handed shots. So they have Carpenter out in that bumper role that Shaw was in previously. And again, that's about puck retrieval and allowing the rest of the unit to continue to move. And they're struggling in that area right now.
Yeah. And right before Carpenter, they had Adam Boqvist in that role because they just wanted a right-handed shot guy, but then they quickly moved away from that experiment because they figured that that's not the kind of guy that you want in that role. You want Boqvist running the point. And then that they moved out Nicholas Beaudin. So yeah, they're really missing that puck retrieval kind of guy in Andrew Shaw. And they actually rank number one. And I looked this up in the Sportlogic stats. The Blackhawks rank number one in pucks recovered off of offensive zone shot attempts on the power play. So like, wow, they're a really good puck retrieval team. And I think Andrew Shaw was a huge reason for that. And now they're trying to fill his void in that bumper role.
Some good news. Connor Murphy activated from injured reserve, missed the last six games of that hip injury. He eats a lot of minutes in a lot of key situations for this team. So the D pairings on Sunday's practice were Keith and Mitchell, DeHaan and Boqvist, Murphy and Zadorov. So that would, if they go with the traditional 12 forward six D, you would think Beaudin and Bowie would be the ones, the odd men out.
Yeah, I mean, Connor Murphy really stabilizes that defenseman group. And I think a big reason why the Blackhawks have been going with seven defensemen is because they don't necessarily feel comfortable with having, you know, giving all these young guys high minutes, right? At least you can cycle through Lucas Carlson and Nicholas Beaudin and Adam Boqvist and Ian Mitchell. So I think now that you have Connor Murphy, it really allows them to play 12 forwards and six defensemen again.
And I forgot to mention, Lucas Carlson is out for 10 to 14 days with a groin injury. So he's also out of the mix. That's why he wasn't mentioned as a healthy scratch. So let's move on to The bizarre NHL story that surfaced on Monday, Artemi Panarin taking a leave of absence from the New York Rangers after his former KHL coach, Andrei Nazarov, alleged Panarin physically harmed an 18-year-old girl in Latvia back in 2011. The Rangers released a statement saying Artemi vehemently denies any and all allegations, that this was a fabricated story. They went on to say, this is clearly an intimidation tactic being used against Panarin for being outspoken on recent political events. So as you looked into this, not only the report from Russia, but how it's being pieced together stateside, what's your take?
Yeah, so this is obviously a story that we have, we don't have all the facts, right? So we can't really jump to conclusion and say, okay, I'm on this side or this side, right? You're going to take the allegations seriously. And I'm sure the NHL and whoever, they're going to look into those allegations. But I thought it was interesting that when this story was breaking and more news started to kind of come out, both from North America, but also what was going on in Russia, it seemed like this was politically driven, right? Like it seemed like Artemi Panarin was very outspoken in an Instagram post in January. And so when I'm doing my research and I'm looking up what the Russian writers are saying and like what people over there are saying, they kind of back that political agenda, I guess. And again, we don't know, like, I'm not even going to try to speculate here on which side I'm on, but I think it was telling that when these allegations came out, the first, like, it seemed like a lot of people came to Panarin's defense in Russia.
Yeah. And the timing, I guess, would be the thing that you would call into question again, as you're trying to weigh the validity of the claim. Like Nazarov said, a criminal case has been opened up against Panarin in Latvia. He also said some money had exchanged hands. They don't know where that came from. You would wonder why it's taken 10 years for this allegation to come to light. And that it comes to light on the heels of not just one, but a few political rants or posts that Panarin has made. So, look, it's not common practice for Russian athletes to speak out against Putin. Obviously, Artemi's in a different spot, making, you know, just signed an $80 million plus contract and living in New York City, but he still has family living there. And I'm sure it's very scary to wonder, and he goes back there every off season, at least he used to. And I'm sure he's concerned for their safety.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think the difficult part about, you know, it's been 10 years since the alleged since the allegations, and it came from a KHL coach that a lot of guys are saying is mentally unstable. And he's, you know, he's kind of like, I don't want to say in cahoots with Putin, but has been really like on his side. So unfortunately this didn't come from, you know, from a woman speaking out saying like, hey, you know, these are allegations that I'm making that happened 10 years ago. I was afraid to speak up then. Like, this is coming from a third party. So you kind of want to respect both sides here as well, that I don't know if like either side wanted this to come out, like if any of this is true, and which I hope it's not.
So certainly we'll continue to follow that over the days and weeks to come. Curious your thoughts on the whole Lake Tahoe situation from Saturday and Sunday. I think we would all agree, or at least I'll say, I can't think of another sporting event that had a more picturesque look than what I saw on Saturday and parts of Sunday. It was spectacular. The snow surrounding the rink, up against the beautiful trees and the mountains in the background and the gorgeous lake off to the side and the colors that you saw. I mean, it was absolutely spectacular, except the ice issue, which, you know, when Gary Bettman says sunshine has always been our enemy, this has happened before. The Hawks, when they played Washington, there was a glare issue in D.C. that afternoon. And I remember that game was postponed X number of minutes / hour before they got some cloud cover and the glare wasn't so harsh on the players. So if sunshine has always been your enemy, you need to prepare for that. And to me, this was a case of, and again, we work for NBC, so I got to be, you know, somewhat careful how I word this. We all know sports is driven a lot by the TV contracts, and NBC carved out a large piece of real estate on Saturday and Sunday to put this unbelievable, marquee, picturesque event on television. And I'm sure they wanted to get the 3 to 4 hours or however long the whole thing would take with pregame and post with this amazing backdrop to it. But if sunshine has always been your enemy, don't get greedy. Do what they did last night. They could have dropped the puck 30 to 45 minutes before the sunset. They would have got their pregame show in daylight for sure. You would have got the first period in daylight as the sun is setting. You would not have had to worry about the ice melting. The second and third periods would have been played when the sun is down, and you don't risk, you know, the black eye and the PR nightmare and having to scramble and put something else into that programming window. I just think like this could have been avoided.
Yeah, it's so difficult because I don't think anyone had an issue going into this game. Like everyone was like, wow, this is going to be an amazing, and obviously weather was good. This was planned months in advance, right? So it's not like the NHL made a decision. They're like, all right, we're going to drop into this warm location and right. we're going to try, you know, because I was talking to this with some of my friends during the game, and they were saying like, how can the NHL put on a really good product when they play an outdoor game at Dodger Stadium, but they can't figure this out for Lake Tahoe. And the problem is, or the difference is that the game at Dodger Stadium was at night, right? Like they didn't have the sun to deal with. The Chicago Washington Winter Classic, that's a more comparable, but this is what I struggle with. I think they were monitoring the weather. Like they were monitoring the weather throughout the weeks, and they felt like there were clouds that were supposed to cover, like, but it never did. Yeah. Right. So I struggle with it because what was the communicate? And this is why I don't want to really jump on the NHL, because what was the communication level like with both teams? With like, obviously the players, and did they want to play? Did they want to say, let's give it a go? Like some players even wanted to go back for the second period, but it was so like the conditions were not safe. Like very clearly
career threatening career. I mean, like you were jeopardizing the player's safety, and you know, they can say that they looked at the, you know, weather forecast and thought cloud cover would come. There's a good chance it wouldn't, you know, and to me, it just seems like a gamble they didn't need to take, that you've got this amazing picturesque scenery. Yes, ideally you'd like it on TV for 4 hours, but if you can get an hour and a half of it, and I mean the rest of that game, I watched the game at midnight here on Saturday night. It was still gorgeous. There was still, I mean, to the degree at 3 in the afternoon, no, but it didn't jeopardize the players in my league, and it didn't make them come back 8 hours after they dropped the puck originally to finish the game. I mean, it's that was just, that's a lot to ask.
Right. I think the difficult part was obviously the sun was going to play a factor. The difficult part was that it wasn't freezing temperatures. So it was really a challenge to keep that top layer frozen. Whereas if they were playing in really cold temperatures, maybe it doesn't melt as easily. Like, I don't know, but man, it's so unfortunate too, because I was looking at the scenery was just absolutely beautiful. And even at night too, it was so cool to see. It's just unfortunate that kind of overshadowed the event.
Yeah. Well, and look, if this was the first or second or third time the NHL did dip their toe into this water, I'd be like, all right, you know, they're learning. You know, this started back in 2008, and I've been to every outdoor game that the Blackhawks have been in, and they've been in a lot of them. And there's always been different conditions. We had the ultra freezer at Wrigley Field. We had rain in St. Louis that threatened that game. We had the glare issue in D.C. We had snow falling at Soldier Field. The ice is always the thing in question when you do these outdoor games. You need to, even under the best ideal conditions, it still isn't always ideal. So when you start tweaking and putting it in these different environments like Dallas or Nashville or Los Angeles or Lake Tahoe, I think it's even more important for the league and those parties concerned to take the proper precautions that they need to try to eliminate some of the variables. And, you know, I think they gambled and lost and, you know, miserably on Saturday.
Yeah. And Pat, can I admit, like, I know they took a risk, but I didn't mind that they took that risk, because here's the thing. The NHL had this game slotted into NBC primetime. And obviously when they moved the time back, they would have lost that primetime slot, right? They got pushed to NBCSN later at night. And then they had to move the second game also from NBC to NBCSN. So I think the NHL was looking at this like, man, this is a really good opportunity. If you guys are cool with it, if we're cool with it, maybe let's just give it a go. I like how they adjusted on the fly after the first period, and they actually did come back. Like, I would have had a problem if they came back and tried to finish that game. Like let's just try to play the second period and then we finish it there, make it a complete game. Like, I don't know. They took a gamble. It didn't work.
All right. So this is where, okay, you and I are both in this business. We're on different sides of the ledger sometimes. I'm more on the TV side of things. How'd you feel for Mike Tirico and Eddie Olczyk having to tap dance for an hour plus, you know?
Well, I will say I probably wouldn't have been a happy writer if I had to cover that game going into midnight and have jump on some Zoom calls at 2 a.m.
So that's a good point too.
Probably the sports writer probably would have had an issue with that as well.
All right. I gotta give a tip of the hockey helmet, as Edzo would like to say, to NBC for the Doc Emmerich piece that they did. Wow. If you haven't seen it, I have to think it'll be somewhere on demand. We are looking into it at NBC Sports Chicago to see if we can re-air it and maybe get Doc in our pregame show promoting it following a Blackhawks hockey game. It is absolutely fantastic. He is such a class act. His story is incredible. The people involved in this, I don't know if you call it a documentary, but we'll call it a doc for the Doc on Doc,
the doc
for lack of a better word. But yeah, I thought it was fantastic. And did you get a chance to see it?
I did. I watched it late last night. I was watching the golf tournament, so I wasn't able to watch it live. But I did watch it afterwards. I got to be honest with you. Like, I knew that they were hyping this up. It completely lived up to the expectations, if not surpassed it. And it was so cool too, because I was fast forwarding through the commercials and it felt like every commercial break was like 2 minutes long. Like, it was so quick. I was like, oh my gosh, we're back here. And I got to be honest, like I got teary eyed like during it, especially when they were talking about the Eddie Olczyk and Doc Emmerich friendship. And they were just talking about who Doc is as a human being. Like, that's so cool just to have your legacy. Like, we all know him as the voice of hockey, arguably the greatest play-by-play guy of all time. But then he's like just as great of a human being outside his work. I mean, that was so cool to see everyone talk so highly of him as a human.
Yeah. And the fact that, you know, he didn't go on a victory tour like a lot of people do. And I'm not saying that's not the right way to do it, but that's just that was never Doc's style. I thought the thing that struck me when he realized, he's like, when I did the number of nights that my wife has been alone, I think he said 5,000 nights she's been alone while I've been doing what I do, I realized it was time for that to come to an end. And I was like, that's why people speak so highly of him as an individual. He gets it.
Yeah. So, and I thought it was so, like, I didn't know this too. I knew he knew it after the season, but the way he was talking about how he was calling the final period of the Stanley Cup, and I was like, wow, like he was the only one that knew that this was going to be his last period. Like, I can't even imagine the emotions that were going on through his head in that moment.
So get a chance to see it. It's at Doc Emmerich. I think it's called The Voice, but it is something really, really cool. Our thanks to our NBC Sports Chicago Blackhawks insider, Charlie Romeliotis. Up next, I chat with Blackhawks rookie defenseman, Ian Mitchell. First up, Ian, how would you assess your first 19 games in the NHL?
It's been special to kind of finally realize the dream of playing NHL for such a storied franchise like the Blackhawks has been amazing. But on a personal level, I think I've made big strides to improve my game, and nice to get a couple goals here too. It's always fun to score. So our team's been playing well too, and hopefully we can keep that up here.
You know, you get your first NHL goal against Columbus. Nick Beaudin gets his about less than a minute later. Were you relieved to get that first goal behind you?
Maybe a bit. That's something that you always think about, wanting to get that first goal. And, Campy made a great play to slide to me on the back door there. Anyone could have scored that one. But, it was definitely really exciting, and a bit of a weight off the shoulders for sure to get that first one.
You almost never see this situation in sports where 7 or 8 rookies enter the lineup together. Every line at times has had a rookie. Every D pairing has a rookie on it. Is there a comfort factor, do you think, entering the league as a group?
I think so. We're kind of all experiencing this at the same time. Whereas in most scenarios that you're maybe by yourself or with one other rookie on a team, this year it's definitely kind of an anomaly that we have so many of us and we all get to contribute to the team, where a lot of us are in the lineup every night, which is pretty cool. And it's definitely makes it more fun that we're having success and winning hockey games. So hopefully we can continue to grow and kind of become a really good team in the future.
So Duncan Keith is a player that you looked up to when you were growing up, of course, drafted by the Blackhawks. You didn't talk to him until this camp. What was that first conversation like with Duncan, a somewhat of a hockey idol to you when you realized you're talking to him as teammates?
Yeah, it was cool. He was on the ice. We were just out of practice, and he came to sit next to me on the bench and just said, hey, I'm Duncan. And I said, oh, yeah, I know who you are. So yeah, I introduced myself. We kind of got to talking. And the coolest thing is that, he's a superstar Hall of Famer, but he just talked to me like he'd known me his whole life. Like he was my friend. Like that was the coolest thing for me, is just he talked to me like we'd known each other our whole lives. And he was asking me about my sticks and where I'm from, and just, yeah, it was just such a thrill for me to kind of get to know them and have that first conversation, just be so regular, not really anything different than what I would have had a conversation with my buddies from home. So that's something I'll always remember for sure.
He's a fanatic about his sticks. So there's some stories I can tell you, but I'll save that for another day. Did you guys bond over the Western Canada thing? Because one thing I always remember Seabrook and Keith would say is we need more kids from Western Canada.
Yeah.
Who've grown up. Did you guys bond on that?
Yeah, definitely. He just the other day we were hanging out and he's showing me his place back in BC there. And, he's just saying, I'm showing him my place back home too. So he's just kind of cool. Well, he likes the mindset of the Western Canadians, I guess. So we definitely bonded over that. He's been a great mentor for me on the ice, and we're starting to have a really good friendship off the ice as well.
So take me back to Denver last year. You came back for your junior year to be the captain and to make a run at a national title. And you guys are ranked 6th in the country, and lo and behold, the pandemic hits and your chances of going for that national championship come to an end. How difficult was that for you and your teammates?
Yeah, it was brutal. We're just gearing up for playoffs, and we think we have as good a shot as anyone to win it all. And that's one of the big reasons that I went back, is that I felt we had a team that could have won the national championship, and we were so close to having that opportunity. But I think that's the worst part, is you don't even get that closure, the finality of getting to compete. And, if you lose out, then, you gave it your best shot. But we had a team that could have won it all, which was really tough, and it was pretty emotional in our dressing room when the news came down that it was canceled. I know I kind of broke down. It was because at that point I kind of knew that I'd played my last game for Denver and I'd loved it there so much, and never really got the chance, the last chance anyway, to try and lead the team and help the team try and win. So something that I'll always look back on, thinking of, you know, what could have happened. But yeah, it's definitely sucked for all of us, for sure.
You're from Kalahoo, Alberta. Population, what, right around 200?
Yeah, I think if you look on Canadian census, it says 85, but I think it's a bit bigger than that.
85. So your dad, Bill, was your coach. You've got a younger brother, Sean. Where's Sean these days?
He's playing junior hockey too, but his season just got shut down last week. So he was playing out in British Columbia for a team out there, but they're done for the year. So right now he's back at home. So mom's happy. She's got one of her boys back at home anyway. So she likes it, but obviously feel bad for him that he can't keep playing right now.
So what was life like growing up in this small town, Kalahoo, and how did you end up going to Denver from there?
Yeah, well, it was definitely cool growing up in such a small town. Everyone knows who you are, and you go to the rink, and all our teams were, if you sign up, you're on the team. We never had tryouts. It was always co-ed too. So we had girls on the team, guys, it was always mixed. So, I think that was great. Just didn't matter who you were, you could come and you could play hockey, and it didn't matter about skill level necessarily, because we didn't always have the best teams because there was no tryouts and there was a small town. So if you signed up, you got to play. So I think that was great for me, just getting to play with the love of the game. I never had any pressure of, you know, having to make the double A team growing up, or like, I just got to play for fun. And I think that really kind of nurtured me into loving the game in the way that I do. So, and then having my dad as a coach was cool too. He would always push me to try and be the best player I could be. So then once I did end up moving on to higher levels of hockey, playing junior A in Spruce Grove there, started getting some notoriety from NCAA schools. And once I visited Denver and talked to them at the coaching staff, I just loved it there. So, that's why I ended up going there, and I'm really glad I did.
Did you play at all in St. Albert? Alberta?
Yeah, I played there for 1 year of midget hockey, and I went to school actually in St. Albert. I was born there, and then we moved out to Kalahoo, which is about 20 minutes away from there.
Okay, so I understand that rink has three different rinks, and one of them is named after Troy Murray.
Yeah, yeah, that's right.
Has he talked to you about that?
Yeah, yet? I've actually talked to him a little bit. We text every now and again, so it's kind of cool that he's with the Blackhawks now, or involved with the organization. After I skated on his rink for a lot, I skated there a lot growing up. We'd always have practice there. And so, yeah, it's definitely cool that I kind of know him now.
So you grew up an Oilers fan. I have to think you were dying watching the team that drafted you and you were about to join in the bubble going against the team you cheered for as a kid, and you wanted to be a part of it. Was that the case?
Yeah, it was definitely weird for sure, because I was originally hoping that I was going to actually get to be in the bubble and hopefully play for the Blackhawks, but that didn't end up working out. So then I was sitting on my couch up at the lake with some of my buddies. We were watching game one, and I was a little bit intense there, because I'm cheering for the Blackhawks and all my buddies are cheering for the Oilers there. So it was definitely, we had a lot of fun with it. And yeah, so I know we had a lot of fun with, you know, my girlfriend, and she's a big Oilers fan too. So we were all laughing about it that it ended up going that way.
You went to business school at Denver. You were interested in finance management. Now that you're getting this NHL salary, I assume you're applying some of what you learned in business school to your current financial situation. But have you splurged on anything? You know, this one item that you're like, you know what? After I get that first or second NHL paycheck, this is what I want to get.
Honestly, not quite yet. Before I came down to Chicago, I bought a used car, so didn't really break the bank on that one. So, you know, coming into the year, I didn't know where I was going to be playing. I was, of course, hoping I'd be in the NHL, but you know, always could have been Rockford, and I could still go down there. So, just trying to save up, and maybe at the end of the year, I can treat myself to something nice. So, right now, keeping it pretty low key.
I noticed on your LinkedIn profile that way back in the day, you worked a year at McDonald's. Is that right?
Yeah, just a little summer job there to get some money on there. So, flipping burgers, doing that kind of thing. So it was a cool little summer thing I did.
Did you ever work fries, or were you more the burger flip? Did you work a bunch of different areas there?
Yeah, mostly I was at the tail ringing up people. So mopping bathrooms too. I was kind of the grunt. So I didn't spend too much time there. I think only a summer, but I had a couple shifts. So that was definitely an experience.
Well, let me ask you this. Is there a life lesson that you can learn from that summer that has stuck with you till today and maybe beyond?
I think it's just, you're always going to start at the bottom and you got to work your way up. Like, it doesn't matter if you're working at retail or at a restaurant like that, you're going to start doing the groundwork. And as you move your way up, you're going to kind of become the star, become the manager, whatever it is. So I guess thinking of it now, like right now I'm the rookie and I got to try and work my way up to have a long NHL career. So right now I'm just trying to do what I can to stay in the lineup and help the team. And hopefully I can progress it into, you know, being a really, really big time player in the NHL is my goal. So I guess that's kind of what you can take from that.
Well, you're making great strides week after week. All of us that are watching are seeing, just the reason why you were selected, where you were in the draft, and all the accolades coming here from Denver, why you were a captain. You're a special player, and we're really happy you're part of the Blackhawks, Ian.
Yeah, thanks a lot, Pat. I appreciate that.
So that's a wrap on this edition of the Blackhawks Talk podcast presented by Coors Light. My thanks to Ian Mitchell and the Blackhawks for making that happen, our NBC Sports Chicago Blackhawks insider, Charlie Romeliotis, and we thank you, as always, for listening. We'll catch you next time on the Blackhawks Talk podcast.
If you travel, you know how to pull off a perfect getaway. You know, after you enroll with your Delta SkyMiles Platinum American Express card, you get up to $10 back monthly on U.S. rideshare purchases with select providers, like a car to the airport. You know which remote retreats have the best herbal baths and where the Wi-Fi password is rarely used, because you're the escape artist. It's why you're a Delta SkyMiles Platinum American Express card member. If you travel, you know. Terms apply. Purchases must be on card. Visit go.amex/you know.